The Energy Gang podcast is brought to you by Keiko New Energy, the fastest growing solar inverter company in the Americas. Keiko's been in business for more than a century, and it's been making superior German quality PV inverters since the 1990s. In fact, it's been making many of them right in San Antonio, Texas since 2013. With a wide range of residential, commercial, and utility scale inverters, Keiko works with developers and installers in every corner of the solar market, making it the preferred brand across the U.S. and throughout the Americas. Learn more about Keiko's superior quality and service at keiko-newenergy.com. From Green Tech Media, this is The Energy Gang, a weekly digest on energy, clean tech, and the environment. I'm Stephen Lacey. Welcome. It has been labeled by journalists as a bitter dispute, a smackdown, even a battle royale. They are not referring to Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor or the upcoming season of Game of Thrones. Rather, those are just a few of the descriptors for a new study countering the notion that we can source 100% of our energy from wind, solar, and water. It is a long-running debate that came to a head this week. We're going to dig into the dispute over 100% renewables that has spilled out of academia and into the mosh pit of Twitter and politics. Then, reliability and renewables. Does Europe's better outage record tell us anything about variable wind and solar and the health of the grid? Finally, America just got 10% of its electricity from non-hydro renewables in March. What does that tell us about where we're headed? If you couldn't tell, there's a theme this week, and here to tie these stories together are Catherine Hamilton and Jigar Shah, both of whom are inside the Beltway. Jigar might actually be on a Beltway. I think he's finally got his standing treadmill desk in that exercise room of his that he promised not to use. Is that true?
I have not used the exercise room. This treadmill desk is in my office.
Oh. Well, how does a treadmill desk work? And is it on right now?
It could be. You want me to turn it on?
No.
It actually is library quiet. It was a Kickstarter by this company called iMover. And so they specially designed it to only go up to 2 miles an hour. So you can actually like type and talk on the phone while you're walking.
Man, I have a hard enough time keeping my train of thought just sitting here on the podcast. So kudos to you to be able to talk on the phone, chew gum, be on your walking desk, type, all that stuff.
Drink coffee.
That emphatic no you heard was from Catherine Hamilton, who's a partner at 38 North Solutions. Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
So what happened on Twitter this week? Something interesting, hey, you guys?
Yeah, it was like a dork smackdown, huh?
It was.
I mean, and I include myself fondly in that group.
Yeah, we were all heavily tweeting this week. I actually held back a little bit in preparation for the show because I wanted to understand how people were talking about this 100% renewable study and rebuttal. So let's talk about it and give me a moment to provide some context here. Because I think a minute of setup is probably necessary to get us to where we want to go. I am a writer and editor, so I'm kind of intrigued by narrative and where this story is taking us over time. We're witnessing this major evolution in the public discourse around the possibilities and limits of renewables, and it took a turn this week. From around 2010 to 2011 until last year, two camps started really duking it out in the public square, again, largely on energy Twitter, over innovation versus deployment. You've heard this one over and over. We've covered it on the podcast. It's also played out at Green Tech Media on the site. At its most basic level, it is this. Innovation folks say wind and solar aren't enough, and we need to fund major low-carbon breakthroughs that could revolutionize energy in coming decades. That's the Bill Gates Breakthrough Institute argument. Deployment folks basically say, let me show you the money. This is the Jigar Shah argument. We've got the tech today. It's all about deployment models and financial innovation. And, renewable storage and efficiency are getting financed and built at record speed. So let's do as much as we can today. I've kind of taken a step back from this debate a bit. I think a lot of people have. I'm more fascinated by how the debates are constructed and what they say about the movement itself and the tribes that guide it. So the debate has found new framing. That brings us to today's episode. Before it was largely academic, renewables were relatively expensive, but now that deployment is winning today by default because the cost of solar and wind are dominating utility planning, the folks on the innovation side are saying, wait a second, now we've got a path dependency. Is this trajectory of dominant variable renewables an optimal design strategy for markets and cost? This isn't theoretical anymore, because the costs alone for conventional renewables and the policy enthusiasm now for 100% renewables is winning the argument for deployment, winning in many circles anyway. So in steps Stanford professor Mark Jacobson and some colleagues in 2015 with this study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that said wind, water, solar, and underground storage could basically take care of all America's energy needs by 2055. He sort of reverse engineered the grid. And this study took off. Celebrities like Mark Ruffalo and Leonardo DiCaprio championed his work. Bernie Sanders made it an integral part of his platform. Cities and states around the country have used 100% renewable energy as their own rallying cry in the age of Trump. Other energy geeks have long quibbled with Jacobson, but this week it turned into a bit of a melee. 21 energy and climate researchers, some of the most respected in the field, published a piece in the same journal concluding that Jacobson used poor modeling and inadequately supported assumptions. They say 80% renewables is more realistic. So 80%, 100%, that's a lot of renewable energy. Just another part of the peer review process, right? Healthy scientific progress? Oh, hell no. So many people are passionate about this issue. I think a symptom of the urgency of climate change and the speed at which things are changing, that the debate became personal very quickly. The last few days have brought personal attacks, a litany of tweet storms, and an insane amount of press coverage. So I think it's helpful to break this conversation into two parts. First, what does this new study say that Jacobson got wrong? We'll talk about that a little bit. Secondly, I think is the most important conversation, the reaction and the impact of the dispute. Why does this matter? And I think we'll spend some time going through what the Twitter community asked us to cover. So, Catherine, what is the exact beef here? What are these researchers saying that Jacobson and his colleagues got wrong?
Yeah, so one thing just to stipulate is that what nobody disagrees with is that we have to get to a zero carbon future as quickly as we can. The issue is everybody has a slightly different vision. Their beef is actually doesn't present a vision. Clack and his colleagues do not say there is a specific pathway we need to do. They do quibble with the analysis methods, the assumptions, the modeling gaps that they see in Jacobson's work, including...
Well, they do early on reference an 80% renewable scenario and just say others have said that this is a more optimal scenario, but they don't make a broader conclusion that that is necessarily the right way.
Right. And they don't lay out any kind of technology pathway. They really just talk about how Jacobson excluded certain technologies that they consider commercially available, like nuclear power and bioenergy, that he includes technologies like underground thermal energy storage that isn't widely deployed or commercially available, and uses that much more than he does commercially available battery storage. He assumes flexible loads modeled for 8 hours at a time when it's much more real time needed. And he also has some pretty big assumptions about hydro facilities ramping up. He leaves out transmission siting issues. There are a lot of things they say that he leaves out of his analysis or he gets wrong in his analysis. But the key is that this is an argument over modeling rather than on should we do it. And in the end, you know, if you really get through the end of his report and look at his policy recommendations, which we can talk about in a little bit, they are not off the chart in, you know, what typical policy recommendations might be if you really want to move to a primarily clean energy future.
Jigar, what do you think are the most important things that these researchers pointed out that were faulty in the Jacobson study? The hydropower piece seems to be the biggest one. So it assumes hydroelectric output past 1,300 gigawatts. That's 10 times existing capacity, 13 times the number of existing turbines. We know that it's very hard to site hydroelectric power. That is way beyond what government estimates say we can put on. And it assumes almost instantaneous turn on and turn off of hydropower. It also assumes concentrating solar power in the Midwest in a big way. And previously it assumed CSP in New York. And I know you don't take kindly to CSP. So do you want to say anything about those two issues?
You know, I'd rather take this from a different perspective because I feel like this argument is sort of made to try to make Jacobson and his fellow authors, you know, sound clueless. And I feel like it's not the right approach. I mean, I was involved early on with the Greenpeace analysis, which was basically a modified spreadsheet exercise, right? You just said this number multiplied by this number is going to be how many solar megawatts you have the next year, right? And that's how they got to 100% clean energy in their analysis, which, as you've noted multiple times, has been the most accurate forecast that was put out in 07. And when I met Mark Jacobson early on with Mark Ruffalo, I don't think they were doing something that much different. So I think when they came out with their first study in 2010, the difference is that Jacobson is not doing an electric decarbonization. He was including transport. So he's got hydrogen for large trucks. He's got all sorts of assumptions that he had to make to get existing technology out in the marketplace. And then every year he's joined with other researchers, now up to 85, I think, co-authors in the latest paper, to be able to try to make this more academic. But he has not done a sophisticated transmission model. He has not done all these things. And on the hydro side, sure, he said, well, I think we can put in more pipes. I think we can put in more turbines and we can let the water dam up behind and create instantaneous power. I don't agree with most of these assumptions. I think I was one of the biggest critics when it showed that New York State and New England had concentrating solar power, which he has now taken out of the mix. But I think people don't understand what this was for, right? This was for exactly what it accomplished, which was to inspire people to think about 100%. And because remember, when Jacobson came out with his study, we were all arguing around 30%.
Okay, that's true. And you've already kind of stepped into the implications of this debate, and I want to get there. You've raised some really good points about what this study was intended to do. But I think this matters, right? And I do want to just spend a few minutes to talk about the assumptions of the study. When we sit here and rail on EIA, for example, for its assumptions for future scenarios in renewable energy integration, they're way conservative. And now we're looking at a study on the complete other end of the spectrum with pretty broad assumptions about hydroelectric capacity, about underground storage that has not been proven at a commercial scale that would be scaled to, you know, nearly every community in the country. We're talking about a scale up in marine energy like tidal power, which is, you know, largely failed over the last decade, aside from a few projects. Again, CSP in weird areas, a technology that, you know, still struggled even in the highest solar resource areas. You know, there are a lot of assumptions here that I think are important to talk about if we're thinking about this as a serious document, which it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, I mean, that's, everyone is taking it very seriously. It is
who
part
is
of the
everyone?
Bernie Sanders campaign.
No, come on. You're talking about Martin O'Malley talking about 100% fossil fuel fury, Bernie Sanders jumping on the bandwagon, and now a few legislators in Massachusetts and California talking about 100% goal. The implementation will still be done in California, at least, by the CPUC and the CEC, and there will be very thoughtful people that figure out exactly how California might hit that goal. And I guarantee you they are not starting with Mark Jacobson's report.
I agree with Jigar that his is aspirational, and it gets people to understand that there is a way to get to 100% renewables. I think that there are big holes in what we're considering that to look like. So there's, when he looks at matching electricity power directly with supply with demand, and I think that's just not a great way to look at our system. We're not looking at deep energy efficiency or using buildings as mass and smart inverters and smart grid and really using the load side as a resource and doing all this optimization. So there's this whole piece that's not in there. But what it does do is it says to people, there is a way to do this. And his policy recommendations are not off the wall at all. They're pretty basically codes and standards and, you know, a few other programs that we're used to seeing out there. So I don't think aspirationally it's bad. I just think that it's not holistic enough. So there aren't enough things in it. And if we're looking at 2050, there's a whole lot of stuff, blockchain, machine learning, artificial intelligence, all these things that we don't even know what's going to be available then. And if we at least start moving in that direction, which I think some of these states are really doing by setting these targets and aspirational goals, we'll get there and we'll start scaling and bringing in new technologies simply by having those policies in place.
he also open sourced all of his spreadsheets and documents, right? So at some point, like, other people could just say, I don't believe in these things. I'd like to change the mix of technologies. I'd like to add nuclear. I'd like to do this other stuff. The problem I have is that there's a lot of academics out there who are basically saying, unless this actually, you know, like, works in my terabyte, teraflop model using some sort of optical, you know, like, you know, supercomputer, then I'm not going to, you know, like, give it the time of day, which is fine. They don't need to. I don't think this was...
That's not what they're saying.
No, but it is. Like, Chris Clack's stuff, who is the lead author of the piece, is only electricity. He does not work on transportation or any of these other things. He doesn't even attempt to try to you know, unify the decarbonization. He only works on grid, which, by the way, is extraordinary. I love his work, and his podcasts with Chris Nelder and the energy transition are very, very thoughtful and helpful. But it's just like, it's apples and oranges.
Yeah, but Jacobson isn't an expert in things like cement production and industrial processes. And that's where the last 20% of decarbonization really matters, and where it becomes very hard to use just variable renewable energy to make up for the economy-wide emissions, particularly in the industrial sector. So you could say the same thing about Jacobson. He's not an expert in
those. I completely agree with you. And that's why I'm saying it's aspirational. But the question really is that, like, is that what should occur here? And my sense is we should actually have a National Academy of Sciences funded effort that has hundreds, if not thousands, of academics work together in an open source fashion with EIA maybe or others to say, well, what are the pathways? How could this work? What could happen? Some of this has already been done by the International Energy Agency and others, but more needs to be done. I think this is the greatest existential threat of our time. And I was the first to criticize Jacobson when he was including CSP in the plans for New York, because I actually had a policy role in New York at the time at which he released it. That being said, I just think that we are basically going after a guy for inspiring a movement because other people's movements didn't get inspired by him.
Okay, I want to address that specifically, but one last question just on the academic rebuttal first, because I want to help people understand why this matters. Jigar, and I'll ask you this, Catherine, as well. I want to know your thoughts. If we can sit here and criticize EIA for their conservative projections, because they do matter in the policy arena, why can we not criticize Jacobson's work, which is increasingly important in the policy environment? We have 100% renewable energy bills in numerous states around the country. We have tons of cities thinking about 100% renewable energy goals. And, you know, localities can do whatever they want. You know, I'm not going to judge a specific pathway. But what we're saying is that these policies are based on one study that numerous researchers have said, hey, this is pretty unrealistic. Why can we not hold Jacobson's study to the same standard that we hold, say, an EIA study on the other end of the spectrum that's way conservative?
Well, it's a false equivalence. EIA is the official U.S. government analysis, which I help pay for through my tax dollars. So I have every right to say that EIA should be more intellectually honest in the way in which they're doing stuff. I don't fund Jacobson's work. I don't fund, you know, Robert Bryce's work at the Manhattan Institute. I don't fund, you know, a lot of folks' work, and they can do whatever they want. They get money from XYZ Group, and then they actually create their own nonprofit, and they're pushing stuff out there, right? So those are two different things. I don't want to compare EIA and Mark Jacobson's work because they have two completely different functions. EIA is an official government body, which then that data gets inserted into official government proceedings within the public service commissions. Mark Jacobson's work is viewed in the way that it should be viewed, which is aspirational, which is probably a little bit more academically rigorous than Greenpeace's work, but not that much more.
Yeah, and I would just not say that having a paper like this out there as an aspirational vision of one way to get this done is in any way making the laws in these states that are setting 100% renewable energy goals. I mean, what you have to do to get a policy done, like, this paper is one tiny piece of it. You have the vision, you do analysis and back it up. So, you know, you may have several different things you're looking at for, like, how are we going to actually get done how are we going to meet these goals? You have to look at the technological viability and resource mix of wherever you are, whatever that state is. You have to come up with the policy instruments. Are we doing grants, tax credits, goals, mandates? How are we doing it? That's just the policy piece. Then you have to mesh it with a political pathway to get it done. So when you do legislation, you have to look at the human being, the constituent impact. You have to look at what does the industry believe can happen? What do the utilities believe that can happen? That's the sausage making piece of it. So, I mean, just this one analysis is only one small piece of what would eventually come out the other end of any kind of legislative policy.
That's absolutely correct. But on the front end, it does have an outsized impact. This one study has motivated an entire movement. That's important because it dictates the kinds of pathways that legislators choose. So in California, you know, do they choose to spend their political capital and time to fix their cap and trade program, or do they push a 100% renewable energy target? In Massachusetts, there are two bills floating around. I was going back and forth with Jesse Jenkins on this, and Jesse's here based in Massachusetts. And he said that there's two bills floating around. One is for 100% renewable energy. One proposed by the governor, Charlie Baker, is for a decarbonization target, which would allow all technologies to compete. And so, you know, does that influence a specific policy prescription if people are relying on this one study? I don't think we have an answer for it yet, but I do think it has an outsized impact on the debate. And I would much rather see a CO2 reduction target and then to allow technologies to compete rather than saying, let's get 100% renewable energy from just wind, water, and solar and limit technology choice.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that those two opposing bills in Massachusetts or seemingly opposing bills may yield the exact same result. Because if you do compete, then a lot of these more expensive technologies aren't going to move forward. I do think, though, that policy does matter and does influence decisions that you make on what you deploy. And you need to figure out, you know, what's the vision for your future? Do we want a zero carbon future? And then what are the policies we have to put into place? And Jacobson's list of policies are pretty much standard codes and standards, incentivizing landlord investment and efficiency, promoting incentives, municipal incentives for energy efficiency, energy supply measures like RPSs, production tax credits, incentivizing energy storage, utility planning and incentive structures, and then transportation and industrial processes. I mean, TOU rates, these are not outside the box, really, policies. So if someone were to take his paper and say, I wonder what the policies are that I could put into place to really start me moving down this path, his policies are not really outrageous. The one thing he doesn't have in here that interestingly was that none of his policies increase research and development. So that piece is not in here. And, you know, if you really want to get to some of these technologies and have them work, like have CCS work or have some of this advanced nuclear work, you really need to focus on the R&D piece of it.
Well, I also think that this sort of libertarian approach to policy is, you know, sort of belies what has worked. And when you look at, for instance, in Massachusetts, where they had the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative, which legislation passed in 1998, Rob Pratt was basically anti-solar for most of his tenure. And so none of the money was used because none of the other technologies were actually prepared to put in the sales and marketing efforts to be able to put the technologies out the door, right? And so it wasn't until, you know, they shifted all the money to solar that program was successful. And so I don't think that any money from the private sector is going to go into fourth generation nuclear unless there's a carve out for nuclear. I think if you said, well, it's CO2 decarbonization and whatever the best technologies are will win, it's probably going to be a solar and wind bill.
I think we need to reevaluate all our assumptions here, because 100% renewable is often confused with 100% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And just because you have a ton of renewable energy doesn't mean you drop greenhouse gas emissions by the same percentage. That's super important to think about, because when you start developing policy and your goal is decarbonization, then you have a whole host of other things like transportation planning, city planning, energy efficiency in buildings, really basic things that, you know, are outside of what Jacobson is modeling here and what is even part of the debate generally. And then with that said, when it comes to, you know, next generation nuclear and even the nuclear reactors that are being developed, for example, in Georgia, the Vogtle plant or the Kemper CCS plant, we had a conversation with Jesse Jenkins, who has done a lot of modeling on the costs associated with those plants. And he said that in a 100% decarbonization scenario, after you get past the, you know, 80% carbon reductions, those technologies look very competitive. You know, no matter how you run the models, those technologies are competitive with a 100% renewable energy scenario, just because of grid constraints, you know, the spatial issues with developing grids to reach renewable energy to load centers, because of land constraints. You know, there are a number of reasons why those technologies still do pencil out in these really deep decarbonization scenarios.
I would love to see Jesse go to Georgia and get them another nuclear plant. I mean, like, it's literally, this conversation is devoid of the fact that we're a political country, that and energy is deeply political in the way in which it's regulated. I just think this notion that you're going to rate base another $17 billion plant right now in any state in the country is crazy.
Yeah, and Mississippi Public Service Commission yesterday just said, forget about it to Kemper. They said, you're only going to operate this as a natural gas facility. By the way, probably the most expensive ever built. They're going to remove risk from ratepayers for this whole gasification issue. I mean, CCS has not penciled out and has not been proven. And this is exhibit A of that in this country.
Right, and has not penciled given today's environment. And I totally agree that, you know, modeling the economics of a decarbonized energy system is completely different from the near-term ratepayer impact of an individual project. So totally on board with that reaction. But let's, you know, I think what we're missing too is that people assume when they talk about 100% renewables, again, that means massive decarbonization. And what they fail to recognize, many of the liberal environmentalist supporters of this plan, they fail to recognize that natural gas has played a huge role in recent decarbonization, and that renewables are only starting to play a significant role. The phase out of coal and the increase in natural gas has been a huge driver of decarbonization in the electricity sector. And so if you take those off the table, right, which a lot of people want to do, and you say, let's go 100% renewable, that starts to change the decarbonization equation. And I just think that people are conflating these two things.
But I also think you're cutting yourself out of all of these other things that aren't nuclear and natural gas, which are deep energy efficiency and demand response and DER that can convert loads into resources. I'm like, we're leaving out a whole piece of the mix there, which calls for energy efficiency and smart grid and optimization of resources on the edge of the grid. And that's just like everybody's pretending that doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, this is the challenge, right? Is that I get where you're coming from, Stephen, but it's still a theoretical conversation. I think when you think about what many of us worked on from 1999 through 2007 or so on RPSs, the vast majority of RPS legislations were not passed for decarbonization. They were passed for diversification away from natural gas. Natural gas price spikes crippled the California economy. They crippled many of the economies in the West. That's why we passed RPSs. Most of the legislators locally did not pass them to promote renewable energy. Most of them passed them because natural gas was so unreliable from its volatile nature in terms of electricity prices. And then when you think about like where we are in natural gas, you can be anti or pro natural gas. It doesn't matter. We still have 500,000 megawatts of operating natural gas plants in this country that can basically run the entire grid for most of the time. So like, you know, most of them are, I think, are still running at 40% capacity factors or less. So it doesn't matter if we never build another natural gas plant again and all of the activists work, you know, their magic. Those natural gas plants are still going to be around until 2040, 2050.
Catherine, do you think we're highlighting our differences when in fact there's way more agreement on where to go?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think everybody's vision might be a little bit different about the path that we take, but the end goal seems still to be pretty clear, which is we need to get to a zero carbon future, and we need to make sure we don't go above 2 degrees centigrade. And I think that with that, if we keep that in mind and we don't get, drop into like snark and patronizing comments, like I think then we'll be much better off. And I think it's important to have these discussions, and it's important to have differences of opinion. I think that's healthy. I think it's healthy to have the debate. I mean, in the end, what's going to impact policy is real political leadership.
Let's just touch on the final piece of this. And this is Jacobson's reaction. You know, we're not here to attack Jacobson. In fact, Shale Khan and I and our other podcasts are going to invite him on, and Chris Clack. And we're going to kind of dig into their different arguments in a deeper way. Because I think there is actually a lot of agreement. And if you listen to Chris Nelder's interview with Christopher Clack on the Energy Transition Show, you know, Clack has respect for Jacobson. So, you know, when you get beyond the Twitter debate, like, these are academics trying to critique each other's work, and this is a totally normal part of the scientific process. I will say Jacobson's response through Twitter in particular, in which he attacks the researchers, many of whom are some of the most respected energy and climate researchers in the field, says they took fossil fuel money, you know, really challenges their motives. These are legitimate academics and energy experts who are trying to figure out the best pathway. And he, in many cases, viciously attacked them and has been on the offensive. And I don't think it helps his cause at all. And I honestly think that the worst part of this process has been Jacobson's response himself, not the actual critique of his paper.
There are a lot of people out there who need to rein back their Twitter.
Yeah. No, this was a classic case study on what not to do when attacked, right? I mean, what Mark should have done is actually said, my papers are peer-reviewed, and I respect the peer-review process, of which this other paper was part of that. Basically, the back and forth of academics is fully natural. And then what he should have also said was that he's proud of the fact that 100% renewable energy is now on the table for discussion, which it was not before his paper.
Right. So we look forward to talking to him in greater detail, and Chris Clack, and you can, you know, hear that in the future. I just have one final thing to say that's really been gnawing at me, because we live in a time when, like, science itself and the very nature of facts are under attack. And liberals, who are largely the folks who've taken up the 100% renewable energy cause and are so defensive about this report and often vitriolic on Twitter, are, you know, they lament the fact that science is being undermined. And this is a peer-reviewed process. This is how academic and scientific research gets improved. It's about challenging our own assumptions, defending your modeling, building off our new understanding of previous research. And that's what this new study is trying to do. I don't think they're attacking Jacobson. You know, maybe it comes across that way in the Twitter sphere, but academically, you know, it's just part of the peer review process. And so I just, like, implore our listeners to open their minds, stop using these debates as a Rorschach test to see what you want to see, embrace the fact that this is how academia works, how the scientific process works. This is an important contribution to our understanding of how low-carbon energy systems can be deployed. There are a lot of different pathways. So, you know, if there's anyone who can step out of the muck and kind of reassess their assumptions and keep an open mind, I think it's our listeners. And that's what I want people to take away from this. All right, we need a little mental break after that one before we go into the second two segments. And this break is devoted to Keiko New Energy, our sponsor. Keiko is one of the fastest growing inverter companies in the Americas, a result of its commitment to quality, top-notch performance, and state-of-the-art technology. Keiko produces its inverters for the Americas in San Antonio, Texas, where 20% of its employees are U.S. military veterans. Keiko is ready to serve any installer or developer looking to maximize their solar production. That is because it has a robust portfolio of inverters for residential, commercial, and utility-scale applications. Leading developers continue to choose Keiko because of its superior engineering and unmatched levels of technical support and customer service. You can learn more about Keiko's inverter models and its commitment to quality at keiko-newenergy.com. Oh, well, we've spent so much time on Twitter. Time to talk about another story that got a little traction on Twitter this week. I tweeted out this chart from Dan Sugar, the CEO of Next Tracker, which compares outage levels and renewable energy amounts between Denmark, Germany, and the U.S. Jigger actually turned me on to that chart. It shows that Denmark, which has more than triple the amount of non-hydro renewables of America, and Germany, which has double the amount of renewables, both have 10 times fewer outages than the U.S. And the implication is that renewables don't hurt the grid or even provide a benefit to stability. So that data point was also used in a prominent op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle written by California Energy Commissioner David Hochschild and a member of the California Independent System Operator Board in this prebuttal that this prebuttal to the much ballyhooed Rick Perry baseload study coming out. I got a little flack from Twitter for my use of that chart. I do put context in the story, but people fairly pointed out on Twitter that you can't compare the two regions, and the presence of renewables tells us nothing about outages. So can it tell us anything meaningful? I wanted to bring this stat up because it's one that I'm seeing pop up more and more, and Jigger, you sent me that link to Sugar's chart initially. Why were you compelled by it?
Well, I mean, I've been faced with this firsthand in the DC area, right? DC area is one of the worst places in the country, you know, where we average over a day worth of outages in Montgomery County. And we had actually a multi-day outage, actually like 5 days of outage that year, when the derecho came through, the DC area. And the conversation around that was around tree trimming and around burying power lines and all the things. So we had this really intense conversation around what it would take to improve reliability in the state. And I was contrasting that with all of the basically lying that was done by utility companies for years around how the grid is going to become more unstable when you put in more variable renewable energy resources and all this other stuff. And I was like, wait a second, we already have an unstable grid. Like, you know, basic weather patterns tend to take our grid down on a regular basis, and you're basically blaming it on renewable energy.
So what you're saying is that our outage problems exist currently, and it has had nothing to do with renewables in the U.S.
That's right. I completely agree with what the Twitter folks were saying, which is this is not causation, it's correlation. But I do think that, you know, it's amazing to me how many people, less today, I would say, than 5 years ago, but how many people basically are saying, well, you know, the grid would be a lot safer and a lot more reliable if we had a lot less renewable energy on there. I mean, frankly, the First Energy CEO has said that over and over again.
Well, and there's sort of two ways to look at it. One is local. So, Jigger, as you think about, you know, a tree falling on a line in your neighborhood or, you know, a specific feeder out because of a weather event versus the full grid and what does the grid need? Now, we've had big grid outages like, you know, back in 2003, when a branch in Cleveland took out, you know, the entire ISO in the Northeast. But generally, on a large scale, we have a pretty good system, and it has nothing to do with whether renewables are on it. In fact, during the polar vortex, you might remember that natural gas had to be diverted to home heating because it was so cold, and the coal was frozen on trains. So what came into play? Well, renewables kept spinning, and also demand response was there. So all of these technologies that we have out there that can serve as resources, whether it's renewables or, you know, grid demand response and DER on the edge of the grid, I mean, those are what can come into play when you're looking at the full system.
Important to talk about the outages in Europe versus the U.S. The U.S. is, of course, more susceptible to extreme weather, hurricanes in particular. And if you look at outages over the last few years, around half of them are caused by hurricanes. And of course, Irene and Superstorm Sandy were devastating to the electric grid. And that of course, has an impact on the statistics. And in Europe, they bury a lot of their infrastructure. Their distribution infrastructure is, the lines are often buried. And that is a huge component, combined with the fact that they see less extreme weather compared to the U.S. But I agree with both of what you're saying. What we are saying is that the presence of renewables can actually improve reliability in certain situations. And in general, it doesn't hurt reliability. There are certainly regional differences in terms of outages, but we can't say that lots of renewable energy causes more outages. This is really important because we're waiting on this Rick Perry study showing why wind and solar are damaging to baseload power and potentially grid stability. We don't know what's in that study yet, but you know, there are a lot of assumptions. And this is another data point, I think, to keep in mind as we await that study.
Well, and it's important because we're marching towards 80% renewable energy in this country. And as we march towards that, the voices around this reliability piece will get louder and louder, and we have to set this particular criticism aside.
Yeah, and so I would just refer everyone to look at this report from Advanced Energy Economy and American Wind Energy Association that is sort of the pre-buttle report about there's no evidence that changing power mix endangers electric system reliability.
Final point for me, one of the big issues with grid reliability in the U.S. has been the lack of infrastructure investments throughout the late 80s and into the 90s. I mean, we just saw a real drop-off in investment, and those investments have increased, and many of those new investments are a result of utilities trying to find unique alternatives to developing new poles and wires. We're seeing a surge in investment infrastructure on the distribution system and the transmission system to accommodate renewables and new behind-the-meter DERs and to fit into the structure of, say, what New York is trying to develop. So, you know, that's all coming together to potentially improve reliability, and it is a direct result of the coming surge of DERs.
And there's also, you know, we're looking at the grid more holistically now and how do we use it better. So there's the energy imbalance market that brings Western states into the market, the real-time market, 5 and 15 minute markets in California, which really does help use renewables that, you know, they do have grid ties and they do have transmission. We need much more of it. But there are constructs out there that are trying to help us be able to use those resources that are not at load centers to bring them closer to the load center.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the final topic. We're going to do a quick stat check to round out the show. The EIA reported last week that the U.S. got 10% of its electricity from wind and solar in the month of March, a significant milestone. Those resources averaged out to about 7% over the course of the year. Wind picked up the large majority of that generation, but solar accounted for 3%. And it was only a couple of years ago when solar was at less than a half of a percent of generation. Remarkable. Catherine, what does 10% tell us about what's going on with renewables and the electricity mix in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, it's significant in that it's more nationally than we've ever had for those technologies. But what's really interesting is that we get far more than that when you look at very specific parts of the country. So I was just at this Mid-American Regulatory Conference where there are about 15 states in the middle part of the country, including Texas and all the states that are in the Southeast Power Pool. And they were talking about, you know, ERCOT getting 40% of its energy from wind, SPP, the Southwest Power Pool, getting up to 60% sometimes. So in certain areas, they're getting a lot more than 10%. And they're managing it. They are, these parts of the country, especially in the middle part of the country, is very long on capacity. So they're talking about how do we integrate all these renewables with demand response, transmission. But the 10% to me is just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, I also love that, like, when EIA sends, has a chart that talks about how much renewable energy is of the kilowatt hour sold in each state. And the top states are Iowa at 37%, Kansas at 30% wind, North Dakota at 21% wind, Oklahoma 25% wind. And then you get to California, which is at 20% wind and solar and small scale solar. And then you get to like Colorado at 19. So, I mean, the states that have the highest percentage of total kilowatt hours coming from renewable energy are, you know, all states that voted for Trump.
That's right. I can never repeat this statistic enough. At least as of last year, over 85% of wind projects were installed in Republican districts, which is, of course, why in the congressional budgetary process, you actually see far more support for this stuff. And we've talked about that so many times, there's no need to really mention it again. But the solar number jigger, all of a sudden, EIA is focused on smaller-scale solar, not just utility-scale solar, and they're showing 3% of generation nationwide. That's a big increase over a couple of years, and I suspect we'll see another big jump over the next couple of years. What's the significance behind that solar leap?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly a very large significance around EIA finally including small-scale solar, which they started to do last year, because small-scale solar, I do think, has a huge impact on the grid itself, much more than the utility-scale solar. And I also think that that the numbers are starting to get meaningful from a merit order standpoint, right? So when you think about how electricity is dispatched in wholesale power markets, it's the lowest variable cost resources that are allowed to run first, which for solar and wind is, you know, viewed to be zero. And so they're always allowed to run. So when you're at 10% of the U.S. Grid, then you're actually always being allowed to run, which then depresses wholesale market prices, which is what's leading to the accelerating decline of the economics of fossil fuel generators.
Well, this show in particular, of course, had a theme about the increasing role of renewables in the electricity mix. And if there's one thing you can take away from it, it's that this is not an academic debate. This stuff is happening now in real time. We're looking at a pretty dramatically different electricity system from when we even started this show. And I'll kind of look back on this show as a milestone for how folks are talking about this issue.
Well, yeah. And when Jigar gets those solar panels up on the wall, you know, then it'll just increase it by another 10%.
It really is extraordinary how Trump yesterday was like, and I came up with the idea of putting solar on the wall.
Wait, let's take a step back. What did he say? So Trump reportedly met with Republican lawmakers a few weeks back and said, in order to sweeten the deal, I'll put solar panels on the border wall. People had been joking about that for a while, and then Trump actually came up with a serious proposal. And then the other day, he was talking publicly about it and gave a speech. What did he say, Jigar?
He said, a solar wall, so it creates energy and pays for itself. Mexico will have to pay much less money.
I don't even know how to respond to that. I mean, I
love it. Honestly, like, I mean, since I wrote this Onion article in January 3rd in 2017, I like the fact that there are all these right-wing folks who are listening to the fact that solar works, right? I mean, that solar actually works, right? I mean, I hate the wall. I hate everything it represents. But I love the fact that they're saying that solar power works.
Well, a sign of the times, folks. The president will only talk about solar if it's on top of a 12-foot wall bordering Mexico. I don't know what else to say about that. But we do have some other notable novel stories in our daily lives that we've been paying attention to, and we're going to tell you something you may not know. Catherine, what's your story?
Yeah, so there are two things going on as we tape. One is that FERC is having a technical conference on the state of reliability, and they're looking at the North American Electric Reliability Corporation's report on reliability. So that's going to be interesting to watch given our discussion today. And it is live stream, so people who, you know, want to can always access it. And then at the same time, Secretary Rick Perry is defending his budget to Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. He did yesterday in front of Senate Appropriations, and he did earlier on the House side as well, where he basically said, I had no input into the budget, so, you know, don't blame me for it. But we'll see how he does. But he's testifying as we tape today.
That's a scary sign if the energy secretary says, I had no input on the energy portion of the budget that the White House proposed. You know, it's another sign that a very small group of people who want to slash and burn government, not make it more efficient, but just decimate government, are in control of the process. Jigar, tell us something we may not know.
So two things from me. One is that the wind energy industry has constantly been bombarded by folks who believe that rare earths are being used by wind turbines. These are rare earth metals, materials, mostly from China. And, you know, I think that WEA has a great report that they just came out with that shows that that's not true, that the amount of rare earths necessary is about, you know, sort of only in about 2% of the U.S. wind turbine fleet, and that most of the wind turbines are using conventional electromagnets made of copper and steel. And so it really is just a canard out there that folks are pushing, but it's important for the wind industry, I think, to face these head on and disavow them. The second is, I just wanted to give a shout out early to everybody who's celebrating the summer solstice. I know there are summer solstice parties across the country starting yesterday, the actual day of the summer solstice, and just want to wish everybody a happy summer solstice. I'll be at the Solar Foundation fundraiser tonight in DC.
And it's the summer solstice, and it's also today National HVAC Tech Day. So for anyone sitting out there in the sweltering heat out west, give a big squeeze to your local air conditioning technician. They deserve it. Extra points if that technician is up on all the Energy Star codes. That is all, folks. Thanks so much. Leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. That's where the vast majority of our listeners find us, and it really helps us find new folks. Push us out on social media. If you enjoyed this conversation or others, tweet at us. Let us know what you think. We want to, you know, debate and discuss the issues with you online as well. And subscribe if you aren't already. We're on every app you can possibly imagine: SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, NPR One, Overcast, any podcast app of your choice. You can contact us at podcasts@greentechmedia.com. Thanks to Keiko New Energy for being a sponsor of this show. We appreciate their support. And remember, we're at the Grid Edge World Forum next week. We're live. GTM Squares can listen on the live stream. And if you're planning on going to that event, we'll see you there. If you're still on the fence, Energy Gang listeners get a 15% discount. You can just use the code ENERGYGANG, all one word, at checkout, and get hundreds of dollars off your conference pass. We're going to have energy pros and utilities and vendors and everybody who's important in the Grid Edge space at that conference. So come join us in San Jose. This was a really fun podcast. There's a lot more to say about this, and I think we covered it pretty well. Jigger, have a great week and weekend, and we'll see you next week in San Jose.
I will raise a rosé to you tonight.
Catherine, see you next week in San Jose. Safe travels.
Yeah, thanks. Look forward to it.
With Catherine Hamilton and Jigger Shah, I'm Stephen Lacey, and we are the Energy Gang, a production of Green Tech Media. We'll catch you next week.